Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
This is Jake and Stacy on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacy Ross.
The Seahawks win week one of the season against the Colts. Once again, it's on the road, much like last year. And once again, much like last year on the road, they won. So what makes this game different than last time? Because to be honest, on paper, you had 28-16 in this one, 38 points scored for the Seahawks in last year's week one opener on the road against the Falcons. And yet, I think all three of us are in agreement that this game for Seattle felt better than that one. So why? Let's start talking about some of the reasons, looking at how the Seahawks have grown in a year with two road opening wins on the road. It's a real redundant day for me.
Well, you know, it's on the road. So if you didn't notice the road that they traveled to get to the road of Lucas Oil Stadium.
Or the opposite of what Jake would call a home stand. No, road stand.
It's a road stand.
It's a road stand.
They went on a quick one-game road stand. Look, for this team, for the Seahawks, I get why people would sit there and say, okay, well, we saw the same song and dance last year. We saw a great offensive start. They got a W in Atlanta. What's different about this team? What's different about this offense? And what's different about, oh, Russell Wilson starting hot and he's just going to fizzle out in the second half? I've seen a lot of those questions out there. Now, I think they're all very valid questions. And what I would say in response is that this team and this group has to earn that. They have to earn changing that narrative or earn changing the conversation from a year ago. But I'll just tell you that this, what we saw on Sunday, is for real. They have to go out and prove that, but this was very different to me than what we witnessed in Atlanta. Let's start off with one simple fact. In Atlanta last year, Russell Wilson was 31 of 35. 31 of 35. That is insane. With the number of pass attempts that he had to be that incredibly efficient all game long, 322 yards, four touchdowns, that part is not the unsustainable part. It's the being that incredibly efficient with that many pass attempts. So that's number one. The other part of it is going into every game saying, we're going to throw it 35, 40 times a game. We're going to rely on our pass game. When their roster, and this is the key part, their roster and their offensive philosophy was not built to be that style. They were not built to go into every game against any opponent to win like that. Did they have the ability to do it if the matchup played favorably to them? Yes. Okay. And for a good majority of the year, that played favorably. Now, when it came time to change, they didn't have the firepower. They didn't have the system. They didn't have the personnel like you've referenced before back in 2013 with Peyton Manning and the offensive juggernaut that they were. Didn't matter who they played. Didn't matter the defensive line pass rush. Didn't matter how great a secondary was. They had the roster, and they were built to be an offensive juggernaut. The Seahawks were in this, you know, in between pseudo, trying to make it happen, trying to expand their offensive horizons and trying to figure that all out and going into uncharted territory with an offensive coordinator, Brian Schottenheimer, who's never done that before. So that to me is what stands out to me the most, whereas Shane Waldron states, this guy has a system in place that he has been well established in this system and this style of football for years. For 4 or 5 years, as he's been going through this and becoming a master of that system, knowing where you want to start, knowing where you want to be, and knowing what the adjustments are when teams try to game plan around what you're showing to begin with. So to me, that is the number one thing that I would point to. Trying to put something together, trying to put it all with a roster that wasn't built to play that certain style, versus a group that reevaluated, has a system, has a personnel to effectively apply that system. That, to me, is what stands out first and foremost.
I think, to me, what stands out is looking at the defensive side of the ball. And I do want to go back to offense after this point as we kind of get a bit later into this conversation. But immediately what stands out is the way that the defense started. I think that the Seahawks defensive line was flying under the radar nationally, certainly with the biggest names being older guys like Carlos Dunlap, or even in the front seven. Everyone knows Bobby Wagner is great, but very few people know anything about Daryl Taylor outside of Seattle. Some people in Seattle, many in Seattle, don't know much about him because they hadn't seen him on the field until this past weekend. Likewise, many people outside of Seattle don't know a ton about Jordan Brooks, who's entering just his second season. You know what I mean? So there were a lot of names that were untested, unproven, young guys. And then the guys that were big names, I think people felt like, well, when's the end for them? And the answer is not yet. Right? The answer is certainly not yet. And we're going to find out what the rest of the year entails. But this defensive line, I think, surpassed a lot of people's expectations in the opener. I mean, they made life easier for a cornerback group that everyone thought would struggle and that ended up being pretty okay. And not only that, but they stopped one of the best run offenses in the league. This is an offensive line that is the number two unit heading into this season, according to Pro Football Focus. Take that for what it's worth. But either way, they have a couple Pro Bowlers, a couple All Pros on this team. That includes their starting guard, Quentin Nelson, who was healthy. He was in that game. He was playing in that game. Wasn't perfectly healthy, but he was in that game. And what you had this year was a defense that gave up significantly fewer yards. Atlanta in week one last year had 506 net yards, including 434 passing yards. They may not have put up a ton of points, right? But it's only because the red zone offense wasn't really converting. They converted. Seattle's defense allowed Atlanta to convert on 50% of their third down attempts last year. The Colts, comparably, were at 38%, which is just below league average.
So my question to you is, do you think it's sustainable? Witnessing, because that's the other part, is week one of last year, offensively, you kind of saw, I wouldn't call it fool's gold because it was, you know, the first 7 weeks, but eventually that tapered off. Whereas the defense, as you're talking about right now, what you witnessed in week one was exactly who they were. And we tried to mask and we tried to say, oh, well, there's these other things going on. We made excuses mm-hmm. for them. And it turned out, no, that's just who they are. Is this sustainable in your mind, the way that they're playing?
It feels like it is right now because the Colts are pretty good on both sides of the ball. They're not elite, but they were 11-5 last year. A solid run defense, a great run game, fantastic running back. You know, one or two decent receiving, certainly good receiving weapons, but they were a bit injured heading into the game there. So they weren't really like at full strength completely on offense. But I mean, hindsight is 20/20. With the benefit of hindsight for Atlanta, we know that the Atlanta Falcons finished with the worst passing defense in the league last year, worse than Seattle. So while Seattle's start on offense was fantastic, we also know they put up 38 points against the worst passing defense in the league. Now, the Colts, we'll see what that defense looks like at the end of the year. Something tells me they're going to be better than Atlanta was last year, which makes me feel better, even though it was comparably 10 points less in this one. I feel better about Seattle's offense being able to pit 28 against a solid team than I do about putting 38 against a secondary that was awful.
Yeah. Well, to your point, though, as well, is that it wasn't just the highlight of the passing game. Right, the Seahawks were able to get the ground game going against a very good run defense in the Indianapolis Colts, and a good front that featured an All-Pro in DeForest Buckner, a very good defensive tackle in Grover Stewart, and one of the best linebackers in the game in Darius Leonard. They got Chris Carson involved. I mean, this was not Russell Wilson having to be perfect all game long in order for them to win. Certainly, he was that. I mean, he was darn near perfect in that game, but it was out of efficiency. It wasn't with him just bombing and attacking and pulling off something that was just very, in my mind, incredible to watch, right? I mean, literally, sometimes the throws that were being made were just jaw-dropping. Now you have the one against, the cover two beater with Tyler Lockett deep down the field. That was a beautiful throw. But this offense is not requiring Russell Wilson to pull a magic out of his hat 50% of the passing attempts. That's what he's been dealing with for the first nine seasons of his career. And in 2021, you have Shane Waldron, who's making life easy on him, finding easy completions, getting him involved, getting the screen game going, getting him out on the edge. And so if you're able to do that with Shane Waldron throughout the entire year, you allow your quarterback to you allow the ability to take stuff off of your quarterback, knowing that he has the ability and will provide you with big moments every single game. You're just not solely relying on that for you to produce points offensively, and that's a great position to be in.
I like the question a lot, though, of whether or not it's sustainable, because if you looked at the stats last year, you knew that allowing 500 yards from an opposing offense wasn't sustainable. No matter how good that win felt, and no matter how fantastic it was to see Jamal Adams on defense have a fantastic day, he gets a sack in week one. I think he had two tackles for loss, a fantastic day for him against Atlanta. Overall, though, you knew that it was not sustainable to allow 500 yards from an opposing offense week in and week out. Thankfully, Seattle's defense ended up getting much better. But looking at this game, do you, looking at both sides of the ball, feel like what they did is sustainable?
The one question that I have is more about the defense, and particularly the defensive line. Can the defensive line feast and generate pressure like they did against Carson Wentz and the Colts as often and as consistently as they did throughout the given game?
Why is it a question?
Because you did have injuries. You did have injuries on that offensive line. Your left tackle wasn't Eric Fisher. Rather, it was Javon Davenport, who didn't have a great game, right? Quentin Nelson, who is one of the best offensive linemen in the league, he came into that game not healthy. So overall, you're wondering, okay, how good was that group? How good was the group that you just faced? And they're going to get another test. They're going to get another opportunity against the Tennessee Titans, who didn't have the best week against the Arizona Cardinals. But can they be as disruptive as the Arizona Cardinals that features Chandler Jones and J.J. Watt?
Right.
Can they be that disruptive? And I think that's a good barometer. Doesn't mean that you need six sacks on Ryan Tannehill to justify or to measure how good they are, but can they consistently generate pressure to make Tannehill uncomfortable and force him into some ill throws, questionable decisions? That, to me, is what I want to see, and that's the one thing that I'm not overly nervous about, but I want to be proven right.
Yeah.
That group can sustain that level of play. That's my one question mark coming out of this.
Yeah, and I also, to add on to that, don't know how long a great pass rush can mask any issues with your cornerback group. It can certainly make them better throughout the course of the year. Like, a team overall with a really solid, even an elite defensive line and pass rush, doesn't need to have the best corners in the game. Like, you truly don't need to have... If you have like this kind of reservoir of talent at certain positions, you can afford to be lacking in others. But I don't know and have not been convinced that the Seahawks have that kind of reservoir of talent at the defensive line. I think they've got a really nice group with, so far, good chemistry, and it blends nicely together. But it's not so much that if you lost three guys, I'd feel 100%
right.
Fine with it. I agree with you. And so I wonder whether or not it's sustainable to mask issues with corners for as
right.
long as you can.
And we're going to find out, because you talk about masking issues. Well, guess what? You're going to face the Tennessee Titans, who are going to feature Julio Jones and A.J. Brown.
Right.
Like, you're going to find out real quick if you can, if your defensive line can get after the quarterback enough, cause disruption enough to limit the play of A.J. Brown and Julio Jones, who can make you pay, which are two mismatches on your current cornerback group.
Yeah.
A.J. Brown, Julio Jones, size-wise, it's a mismatch with D.J. Reed, just very clearly. Trey Flowers, we know the issues that he has had. That's going to be a huge task for those two guys to have. And the defensive line, as I said to you yesterday, that has to be the sustainable aspect of this defense. That's what they're counting on. That's what they need.
All right. Don't forget, Mike Salk is back in the mornings each weekday from 6 to 10 a.m., including the Pete Carroll Show, which is every Monday at 9:30 a.m. Right now, it's time for Headline Rewrites.
Extra, extra, read all about it.
Headline Rewrites.
Presented by Tila Mortgage.
The real story behind the headlines in today's news with Jake and Stacey.
Headline number one, USC making the move yesterday to fire head football coach Clay Helton after six seasons of doing just enough to remain employed. What's the real headline?
Much like Aunt Becky's own dealings with USC, Clay Helton was just trying to pull off this charade for as long as possible. Just trying to make it work for as long as possible. You get your kid into school, and then...
Maybe if I win nine games, no one will notice.
No one will notice. Maybe if I Photoshop myself onto the sidelines at another school. Obviously, this is a play on... what's Aunt Becky's real name?
Lori Loughlin?
Lori Loughlin, the USC admissions scandal in which people actually photoshopped their children on like sailing teams and rowing teams.
It's absolutely insane.
Wild.
It is, but with Clay Helton, there was a lot going on there. It's not just barely sneaking by, but it's also the state where USC as a university was in. They had a whole lot of money issues. They couldn't afford to fire him and afford the buyout at the same time. So there was a lot going on, but I think at this point, what ended up happening is you have a USC fan base and alumni that were just so fed up with what they were witnessing out of USC and just barely hanging on as a competitive program rather than rising, rather than being towards the top every single year, not just in the Pac-12, but from a national perspective. And you're seeing so many of these great, talented recruits getting plucked and pulled from Southern California to the other side of the country, which is something we've never seen before. That's happened over the last 5 years. That is unacceptable, and they need to bring in a star to revive USC. That's going to be the big task for them. And you look at the potential candidates that are out there, USC's in a pretty good spot, and we'll see if they can find the right guy.
Yeah, you had plenty of people asking about Chris Peterson, and we asked Bruce Feldman about it, Fox Sports, and he seemed to think that, like, no, that's not happening. And he's pretty well connected with Peterson.
Yeah, that one would really surprise me, honestly. It would surprise me, and if I was a Husky alum and Chris Peterson takes off to SC, I'd be really upset.
I'd be
really upset.
I would be floored, because it would be, so you left college sports because the feeling of college sports, the kind of icky parts of it, just kind of left you queasy, so you went to Southern California to get away from it? What?
Yeah, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And the pressure as well, the expectations. I mean, that just rises to another level when you're talking about SC. So I really don't see that happening. But I really think there are some good candidates out there right now. You look at Luke Fickell from Cincinnati. He's done an outstanding job. But the guy that makes the most sense that they should be waiting for and they should be trying to lure into Southern California, I hate to say it, but it's Urban Meyer. I mean, he'd be the one guy with the proven track record would instantly, the moment he got hired, would bring all of the buzz, all of the excitement back to USC. I don't know if it'll happen, but Urban Meyer sure doesn't look too happy on those NFL sidelines right now.
Headline rewrites.
Headline number two, reports out there that the 2023 All-Star Game will be played in Seattle at T-Mobile Park. What's the real headline?
The Mariners are making an official announcement Thursday at 1 p.m. I, for one, cannot imagine what it'll be.
Oh, couldn't imagine
that
it might be.
In unrelated news, the Mariners are making an announcement Thursday at 1 p.m.
Yeah, Jeff Passan reports that the All-Star Game is going to be here in Seattle. That might have something to do with it. Is that the legend Dave Sims right there in the behind the glass
Dave
here?
Sims is in the booth with me here.
What's going
Hi,
on,
Dave?
We're just chopping it up.
Just maybe by the time we hit 2023, we're witnessing and Dave Sims, our buddy Dave Sims, is making calls during the season with a very, very competitive team that's featuring a lot of great talent. And maybe they could rival the bring it back of 2001, where you had 8 All-Stars going to that game. Man, that would be pretty amazing if you were able to get that kind of talent back with this team again.
It would be really, really satisfying to have Seattle getting the front and center stage and then also having so many young, exciting stars.
They're coming. I mean, they're on their way, and obviously what they're doing right now is incredibly exciting, and you just hope to see this continue. Not rebuild, but build towards a consistent winner.
Headline rewrites.
Headline number three, Tyler Anderson getting the start tonight as the Mariners take on the Red Sox in a pivotal game two of this 3-game series. What's the real headline?
Get through 6. Get through 5. Get through 6. And I'm feeling pretty good about this bullpen, especially against this Red Sox offense. I mean, I do not want too much of a bullpen day against Boston, because I want you to be able to save a lot of those arms. And we know that when they can take a lead late into the game and just give the bullpen that lead, this bullpen has been phenomenal at maintaining it. So Tyler Anderson, outside of his last start, has been so consistent with that, with getting to at least 5. I'm hoping he can push it one more, but even just get through 5 wasn't as exciting a chance. So I did get through 6. But
get through 6 would be a great effort by Tyler Anderson. He's been phenomenal, and he's been the lone forgotten guy in terms of the moves that were made at the trade deadline. He's been a great great fifth starter for you, and you're going to need him to come up big. And as you mentioned, just get to the bullpen, get through six, let the bullpen take over from there. And gosh, I mean, I know Seawald, there was he made it interesting there in the eighth. But the way that Castillo is pitching right now, coming back from that 10-day IL stint, this guy looks good. Mm-hmm. And you have three shutdown guys, three capable shutdown guys in Castillo and Seawald and Steckenrider. I mean, that's so much fun.
Well, and you're going to have, so you have Tyler Anderson tonight. You have Marco getting the start for a matinee tomorrow.
Yes. I'm
feeling pretty good about both of these guys.
You need the offense. You need the offense to come through. And as we talked about, big time players step up in big time games. Mitch Haniger, JP Crawford.
4-4. 3-4.
I mean, those guys came through in the clutch in a big way. You need those guys. You need France. You need Seager. You need Toro. You need those guys to be big in this series, and it would be great if you had, I don't care who it is, one to two, you know, heroes of the day in the back half of the lineup. You just need a great effort by this group. It's right here. Playoff baseball is in front of us right now in this series with the Red Sox. Last night was so much fun. So much fun that I had to get to the game. So I'm going to be there tonight with my boys. Can't wait. Jackson, Bodie, they're fired up. And let's make this thing rowdy at T-Mobile Park tonight.
And Curtis, are you going tonight also or just tomorrow?
I'm going tomorrow. I'm taking baby Willa to her first game tomorrow.
Oh, now don't forget, you guys, I got you specifically the teal romper with the navy headband for Willa to wear. I thought ahead for Willa's first
game. We may go with that. We also do have...
I also got her a white bonnet that she can wear to the Mariners game.
Did you hear, Curtis? He's automatically going to the other options that they have.
I know,
yeah,
but
baby outfits for her.
Yeah, but when I got you guys Willa's baby gifts and her summer outfit,
this is gonna get
awkward. For which I planned out her entire wardrobe.
Boy, we're right up against the break.
Right.
This is
wow.
Awkward.
Wow. Don't forget you can subscribe to Jake and Stacey wherever you get your podcasts. If you're not a big podcast person, that's okay. You can listen on 710sports.com/podcasts where you don't have to download anything. You can just stream it right on there. If you do download, please don't forget to rate and review. Coming up next, we're gonna take a look around the NFL. 49ers getting two huge injury blows. It's awful news for them. Plus, we're going to talk about the latest with the Seattle Seahawks. Obviously, Scott Servais Show is a reminder coming your way in less than an hour. Don't go anywhere. This is Jake and Stacey.
You're listening to Jake and Stacey.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacey Ross.
Time to take a look around the NFL. Jake and Stacey, by the way, presented exclusively by CarPros Kia Tacoma. Let's start in the NFC West, where 49ers running back Raheem Mostert will undergo season-ending knee surgery. This news comes after it was also reported that 49ers cornerback Jason Verrett suffered a torn ACL. This is just a series, like multiple seasons, especially last year, but multiple seasons, Jake, of just rotten injury luck for this team.
It's incredible. Like, what is going on there that they just can't find a way? And then also, what the heck is going on with the fact that they can find literally any running back they want and get production out of them?
Yeah, it's wild. Who's Elijah, what's his name?
Raheem Mostert goes out. He goes down. He's somebody that...
They got 107.
They feel really good about. And then the 49ers go, no big deal. We've got our other guys, Elijah Mitchell.
That's
who
it is.
Who's a rookie this year.
Had 100 yards.
Yeah, goes for 104. 19 carries for a touchdown. I mean... Just really impressive what they're able to do with that running scheme and that system. But that is going to be something that will be felt. Elijah Mitchell obviously is going to have to take over that mantle, and we'll see if he can do it on a consistent basis. But, I mean, the 49ers, that's the one thing that can get in their way is obviously the injury issues that they've had over the years. But you just look at what they were able to do against the Detroit Lions, and it's the Detroit Lions. It's really impressive when you can put a team away. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Seattle Seahawks have been wildly successful. They don't often beat teams comfortably. Like, it never happens. So I always find it impressive when you do see these blowout wins with teams. That means you're executing well, you're taking care of business, and your talent is showing up and treating every game seriously. And I think that you know, matters and you're not toying with teams, you're beating them the way that you're supposed to.
All right, everyone loves an underdog, and week one was the story of underdogs in the NFL from ESPN. The Raiders' upset of the Baltimore Ravens capped, quote, a historic week for NFL underdogs, where 12 underdogs covered the spread, which is the most in week one in the Super Bowl era. They added that 9 underdogs pulled outright upsets in week one, which is the most of any week in the past 4 seasons. Wild. Oh, by the way, those teams, the Arizona Cardinals, the Cincinnati Bengals, Houston Texans, the LA Chargers, Miami Dolphins, New Orleans Saints, Philadelphia Eagles, and the Pittsburgh Steelers all won as point spread underdogs on Sunday.
That, to me, was probably the most surprising that we witnessed, that we saw. But that's why the NFL, what is it built on? It's built on parity. And you never know going into each and every single season, each and every single game, who's going to win. I think that's what makes the entertainment value of the NFL so incredibly strong. Every franchise, every fan base, pretty much, unless you're the Detroit Lions or somebody of that degree, believes that you have a legitimate chance at getting in the playoffs and maybe, just maybe, getting to the Super Bowl. And it goes to show that you could pick them all you want. Week one is so hard to predict.
Guys, of these teams, so you've got Cardinals, Bengals, Texans, Chargers, Dolphins, Saints, Eagles, Steelers. All of them won their respective games. Do you think there's any one of these teams that we collectively have vastly underrated for the season, or do you think that it was just a one-off? For instance, I think the Cardinals are probably genuinely underrated right now, just being in a really tough division. They may still finish fourth, but they're probably going to finish fourth with a winning record and in a really solid year. And who knows what's going to happen in the NFC West. I am not sure whether the Miami Dolphins, after their one point win over the New England Patriots, can go on and like dominate. I mean, maybe they'll be great in that division, but I mean, I'm still expecting it for the Bills. Like, and there's not much that's changed in the power structure.
Correct.
To me.
I would agree with you. I think the New England Patriots have an opportunity to really be different. Now, they may not go and win the division, like you just mentioned, but I believe they're going to be a winning team. They're going to be in the playoff hunt in the AFC. So the Patriots are somebody that if anybody was overlooking them, Mac Jones came out and showed you that he can lead this group and that he can be arguably the best of the rookie quarterbacks this season. Not in the long term, but this season in particular. So that's the group. That's the team I would look at. The Steelers winning, that's not a surprise. They're a good team. It's really more of the Drew Brees effect with Ben Roethlisberger. Can he sustain his level of success throughout the season? And quite frankly, I just think that Ben Roethlisberger is holding on by a thread. And we'll see if they have a talented enough roster to be able to let Ben Roethlisberger just be a game manager through it all instead of being the focal point.
All right. So this actually came out ahead of week one. We had so much news, I didn't get to it. So I'm cycling back to it. It was NFL executives making their pick for MVP, Offensive Player of the Year, Defensive Player of the Year, etc. MVP, they predicted Josh Allen, obviously quarterback for the Buffalo Bills. Offensive Player of the Year, Christian McCaffrey. Defensive Player of the Year, TJ Watt. Honestly, after his start to the season, I can already see that happening. Offensive Rookie of the Year, they went with Mac Jones or Trevor Lawrence. So going with one of the rookie quarterbacks. Both lost in their week one starts. Mac Jones and Trevor Lawrence, though, had pretty decent performances. Trevor Lawrence threw for a ton of yards. Mac Jones was fine. I mean, none of them, particularly Jones, made like horrible mistakes. But really, the big issue with Trevor Lawrence wasn't Lawrence. It was Urban Meyer and the entire preparation or lack thereof that went into facing Houston. So Defensive Rookie of the Year, Micah Parsons, inside linebacker with the Dallas Cowboys. Comeback Player of the Year, they have a Saquon Barkley. And Coach of the Year, of course, they think it's going to be Kyle Shanahan, the 49ers.
Well, you look at some of these, start with Offensive Rookie of the Year, Mac Jones, Trevor Lawrence. That's a good pick. I think Mac Jones will be in it just because of the winning that they will do ultimately. And Trevor Lawrence, just the sheer fact that this guy is so incredibly talented. He threw for 3 picks, 3 touchdowns, over 300 yards. There's going to be a lot of mistakes. A lot is on his shoulders. A lot is on his plate. He's going to be learning a lot this season. But I believe you're going to see a lot of highlights from Trevor Lawrence this season. And how about Christian McCaffrey? I mean, the Panthers just getting off to an unbelievable start with him. he is such a factor when it comes to the passing and the running game. I mean, he is their offense solely, so he's got a great chance of winning that. But when it comes to the MVP and Josh Allen, Stacey, I'm going to go against this one.
Yeah.
I'm going to go against Josh Allen and the Buffalo Bills. It's one thing to come out and take the league by surprise and see what, you know, Josh Allen was able to have this incredible season. But it's another thing to do it on a consistent basis. It's another thing to do it year after year after the defensive coordinators have gotten a chance to evaluate your tape and see what you do well and how you're trying to attack defenses. It's another thing to be able to continue to keep making those adjustments to stay one step ahead. So Josh Allen, I'm a big fan. I believe he'll be a very good quarterback. It's not to say that, but I mean, he had an amazing year last year. Would not be surprised in the least bit if you see a little bit of regression. And you know, you look at the Buffalo Bills game against the Steelers, they didn't light the world on fire, you know, come week one.
So who do you think is going to be MVP?
MVP, I mean, I really think that ultimately it's going to come down to, I would say, Patrick Mahomes, Russell Wilson, Matt Stafford. Okay, I think Matt Stafford's going to be in the conversation with all the love that he's already gotten in week one. I mean, you just see it. It's off the charts right now.
But I don't think it's misplaced.
No, it's not misplaced, but I believe that he's going to have a lot of the conversation and a lot of the hype enough to drive that conversation forward. And then I think the other guy that you have to always consider is, I know he had a bad week, but Aaron Rodgers and the Green Bay Packers are still a very talented football team. And I know they got their butts whooped against the Saints, but they can easily turn that thing around.
Now, I have a real question. Do you think that Russell Wilson can put up the yardage that's usually in consideration for MVP? Because he had four touchdowns for this weekend, but wasn't one of the players of the week that was spotlighted because all of those guys had like 350-plus passing
right.
yards.
It's a great question.
And also, can he maintain that campaign through a full season?
Yes. I say yes. I mean, I've said that with this system. I believe that this system is completely sustainable. What they're doing is not something that I look on that's teetering towards the edge or that I have serious question marks of whether or not they can keep that going. Last year, you saw what they were doing and it was awesome. It was fantastic. But there was always that question of, well, can they do this? Can they go that pass heavy just in 1 year and flip the script and be that wildly successful with it and not run into any issues? With Shane Waldron in this offense, it is balanced, it is well thought out, it really can be multiple and take advantage of the matchups that's in front of you each and every single week. So yeah, I expect Russell Wilson to put up a bunch of touchdowns. The yardage, I think that's a tough thing to do. I think that's a tough thing to put up 300 yards every single game, but he'll be around that mark. I expect him to be, you know, 250 yards a game, somewhere in that range, and that should put you in striking distance if you're putting up, you know, major touchdowns. I mean, the first half of the season, he was on pace to throw 60. So he threw 40 last year. I expect him to match that, and I expect him to be more around 50 this year.
All right, I want to talk about the powers that be in the NFL for this year. We'll have a little nice measured overreaction to all the week one games and figure out whether we think the power teams are still going to be the power teams. But coming up at 1, we're going to have Scott Service on for the Scott Service Show. So plenty of Mariner stuff coming your way, especially at the top of the hour. Got plenty to talk about. Shannon Dreyer also going to join us. A little more Seahawks talk next first, though. Don't go anywhere.
You're listening to Jake and Stacey.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacey Rost.
Scott Service Show coming your way in 15 minutes. Don't go anywhere. Shannon Dreyer also going to be a part of that conversation. Before we get to it, though, it's time for a little bit of very measured overreaction. Of course it's not measured. It's going to be an overreaction to all the stuff in week one. And with so little to really go off of, you got to stretch it. You got to be bold with some of these. So I'll start with this one. You had the Saints completely demolishing the Packers and Aaron Rodgers. Rodgers threw two picks, including a red zone interception. Jameis Winston had five touchdowns. It was a throttling. It was game over. The Packers looked awful all day long. So here is the overreaction. And let's figure out whether or not we're actually believing it and believing this overreaction, which is that the Packers are done. This isn't the Packers' year. They once again are not going to return to an NFC championship. They aren't going to be able to do it. They're cooked.
My initial reaction is, come on, guys. It's week one of the season. This is a very talented roster. This is a very good roster. They'll be just fine. I mean, they're well coached. They've got the reigning MVP of last year. They've got a good amount of guys back from the same team last year. So there shouldn't be this huge panic over one game, right? And there's something to be said about traveling to Jacksonville, and they just seem to be just flat, completely flat for whatever reason, and could never recover. So I this team is way better than what they showed week one. The Saints took it to them, dominated them, surprised them, I believe, in a lot of ways. They were not expecting to walk into that buzzsaw. So this is a good reality check for the Packers. I expect them to be back. But before I say it's an overreaction, there is something to be said about all of the dysfunction that happened in the offseason. It was not put to bed. Here in Seattle, the friction that was going on in the offseason, the discussions, the tug and pull that was going on, that got settled. There were conversations that were had between Russell Wilson, Pete Carroll, John Schneider, and everybody, where everybody could move forward and not just, hey, we're putting this on the side, but moving forward positively. And everybody feeling good about where they're at heading into week one. The Green Bay Packers, that's not the same case. Everything is still on the table. The hurt feelings, the frustrations, the anger, whatever you want to call it, the indifference of Aaron Rodgers, that is all still very much present. And is that lingering, and will that have a ultimately negative effect on this organization? I think time will tell.
Yeah, I'm feeling still fine about the Packers. Like, if you had Aaron Rodgers on your fantasy team, I wouldn't just dump him and be like, oh, it's over, it's game over. I think every team is going to have an ugly game once in a while. And I think, if anything, it's just maybe the Saints are better than people are giving them credit for. Like, I don't know that they'll be an actual contender, but I think people were pretty quick to write off Jameis Winston, who looked phenomenal. Now, one thing he hasn't been able to be is consistent, so we'll see how he looks next week or the week after. But, I mean, I really do think you just went against a pretty solid team, including a well-coached team by Sean Payton. Now, I have I'm going to combine two here, you guys. So this was the performance from two separate quarterbacks over the weekend. One quarterback was 21 of 32, that's 65%, for 289 yards, four touchdowns, and a rushing touchdown, so five touchdowns total, 121 passer rating. The other quarterback was 20 of 26, which is almost 80%, 76% completion percentage, 321 yards, three touchdowns, 156.1 rating. Those two guys, Kyler Murray and Matthew Stafford, respectively. Yeah. And they both just threw their name, this is my overreaction, into the MVP debate.
I don't think it's overreaction at all. I think that these two quarterbacks are going to be playing for very good teams. They are extremely talented. They've got a lot of weaponry around them, and they have every opportunity to be in that MVP conversation. So have they've submitted their name in for MVP consideration, but there's one guy that I expect to be a part of the conversation all year long, and one that's eventually going to taper off. And it was the same story last year, and that's Kyler Murray. Kyler Murray came out firing. He came out sharp, and eventually he tapered off, whereas I think Matthew Stafford is going to be in that conversation all the way to the end. You know, we'll see ultimately where he lands, but I believe that Matthew Stafford's going to be consistent with high-end performances. Kyler Murray still, to me, is a very volatile player. That doesn't mean I don't think he's a great one, because I think he's a very good young player in this league, and I love watching him play and very excited to see what he can do. But I just think the Cardinals, it's a team that's extremely talented. They've got good veterans. But do they have the winning culture? Do they have the ability to have sustained success? Last year, the answer was no. Can they change the script this year? I'm still not buying it, but I do believe that they are a team and Kyler Murray is a quarterback to be reckoned with.
All right, how about this one? So, like I mentioned in our last segment, you had quite a few upsets this weekend. The Texans beat the Jags. You had the Dolphins upsetting the Patriots. You had the Saints upsetting the Packers. You also had the Raiders with a nice little upset against the Ravens, the Cardinals upsetting the Titans, the Bengals beating the Vikings, Steelers beating the Bills, Eagles beating the Falcons. Of these teams, which team do we think right now that we collectively as an NFL audience have been underrating all season long. Because one of these teams, I would wager, is better than any of us are giving them credit for. And this is not going to be an overreaction. They genuinely are going to be better than we think. My money right now is on the Cardinals, which is the easy answer because they're in a tough division. And if they were in a worse division, they'd probably be favored in it. But if you're looking at, you know, Cardinals, Steelers, Chargers, mm-hmm. Panthers, Texans, Dolphins, Saints.
Okay, let me give you a bold one. I'll give you the Eagles. I think maybe the Eagles have the best chance to be the biggest surprise because everyone is slating the Eagles as one of the worst teams in the NFL and are in a very dysfunctional situation. What if, even with a very terrible press conference in Nick Sirianni, what if he's the guy? What if he, along with...
I think what if Jalen Hurts is the guy is really the big...
Jalen Hurts, I think, is more than talented to be the guy. Yeah. It's really, can you put an offensive scheme and system and talent around him to give him the best results and to bring out his talent each and every single week? I mean, the guy that helped Justin Herbert become a very, very good quarterback is the OC for the Eagles right now. So maybe they have what it takes offensively to be a very good team, and they're going to get a tremendous test going against the 49ers the very next week. So maybe the Eagles are better than what other people have originally thought of them.
All right, the Scott Service Show is coming up next. Don't go anywhere. This is Jake and Stacey.